You are listening to The Creative Curmudgeon. My name is Crone, and this is the first episode of this podcast in over a year and a half. But after getting millions and millions of letters asking me to bring this podcast back, I decided to do so sporadically for special occasions, such as now, when I happen to be talking to the Satanic Puppeteer from San Diego, California, aka Professor B. Miller, who, along with his robot comrade, the SBO-20, make up the Satanic Puppeteer Orchestra.
What's your motivation? Why you wake up every day? We do it for the shareholders. It's in our DNA. Why do we smell the roses?
Is there anything else that you would like to add as your introduction?
I'm glad that my letter writing campaign paid off. That's fantastic. As far as my introduction, if we're just talking about my band stuff, that is a fantastic introduction. I don't know if we're going to delve into art outside of my band.
Let's go with that too. Why don't you tell the lovely people about that as well?
So outside of Satanic Puppeteer Orchestra, I am a mild-mannered graphic designer, Michael Buckmiller, and I design under hand-carved graphics. I do hundreds of posters and album art and websites and t-shirts and all that kind of stuff. Corporate design stuff. So a lot of art, a lot of visual stuff, some movies, some film stuff, short videos, music videos, stuff like that.
I saw that you also did some furniture design. Did I see that correctly?
Yeah. So that was under another brand I've got, which is the Ancient Order of the Volcano. So that was my my mid-century modern kind of brand, where it really just started because I wanted cool-looking mid-century stuff and couldn't afford cool-looking mid-century stuff. So I found some websites that let you design your own patterns, upload them, and then they would make stuff for you, like pillows or curtains or whatever. So I started doing that, and then other people started buying those things. And then I started making other stuff along those lines, like wooden sculptural art pieces and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Eventually, a lot of it recently ended up in the Amazon TV show Fallout. They used some of it in their sets and stuff. So yeah, I've done a lot of mid-century pattern stuff as well.
How did that come about?
The Amazon part or the mid-season part?
Fallout, yeah.
The Fallout, I hadn't really been active doing the pattern thing in a while, and I just got a random email from a woman that was working on that TV show, and she didn't tell me what TV show it was. She just said, you know, we're interested in using your art on a show that we're working on and wanted to know how to arrange that. So I got her in touch with a guy that had all my pieces in his gallery, and they worked it out, and she bought everything that the gallery had on hand and shipped it to New York for their sets. And then they also wanted, in addition to the physical pieces, access to the like patterns. And in the show, they ended up using it as like wallpaper and some of the scenes and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, just through Instagram, I guess, probably found me.
I know nothing about the show Fallout other than recently learning that your art was in the show Fallout. Is it like a Mad Men-esque throwback show where like that style of art kind of like blends in, or is it like is it a modern day show? Or
so I also didn't know anything about Fallout before. I'd heard of it, but I wasn't really familiar with it. It's a video game, and it's a post-apocalyptic video game that sort of proposes like an alternate timeline future. So the aesthetic of the video game and the subsequent TV show is definitely based in like the 50s and 60s. Like it's this retro future atomic era kind of aesthetic to everything. But it's kind of, I guess, set in the future, but a future that looks very different than what our future is. So my mid-century stuff fits very well in the realm of the show. In that sense, that it's very 50s, 60s, atomic kind of stuff.
Let's start at the beginning. Have you always lived in San Diego, California?
I have not. I grew up outside of Chicago and moved to San Diego after high school, and then went to college out here and then just never left.
What part of Chicago?
The Northwest suburbs. I grew up in Palatine.
I was born in Harvey.
Okay.
I don't know where that
Not that
is
far.
in relation.
Yeah.
Okay. What did you do creatively as a kid? Like, let's start there.
All the usual stuff that kids would have done, I would imagine, like lots of art projects or self-directed art projects, a lot of writing, a lot of making my own books or my own stories or drawing my own cartoons, that kind of stuff. Even into high school, I wasn't really taking any of it that seriously. It wasn't really treated as like a potential career path. It was just sort of a thing you do for fun or expression. And most of the people in my family were into drafting, like architects and stuff, like my dad and my uncles and my grandpa. So I was into, CAD drafting and that kind of stuff in high school, and had taken a bunch of classes doing that. But the technical part of it sort of was less fun than the creative part of it. So even within that class, I started pushing the boundaries of what you probably should have been doing in the CAD software to try to make art out of it rather than just design a staircase,
I'm sorry if I'm making an asshole of myself, but what is CAD drafting?
Computer-aided drafting. So instead of doing it by hand in the 90s when I was in high school, they'd started, I guess it was probably AutoCAD or CAD Key or some vintage computer program to do the drafting, where essentially, like when you're drawing architectural drawings, you've got different views, like the top left and side view of the thing, so you can see it from all angles and get a sense of it in space. So the computer made it so that you could draw one of those and it would start kind of connecting the dots and building the other views for you as you went to kind of speed up the process.
I see. What about music? What was kind of the spark that ignited you getting into playing music?
So I took piano lessons as a kid for, I don't know, a month or two, and it didn't stick. I learned some of the basics. I took it with my brother, and my brother got way into it, and he did it for years and years and years and got really good. But I just didn't really, I don't know. It just didn't stick at the time. I wish it did. I wish I was really good at it, but I'm just sort of faking my way through it even now. And I'd always liked music. And I was way into music as a fan of music, but not really as a creator of music. And in high school, I had some friends that started a band. So then it felt very immediate and tangible. Like, you go hang out with your friends and help them, selling merch at their show. And now you're meeting all the other bands they're playing with. And these are bands that I would actually like. I had their CDs, and now all of a sudden it's like a real thing. So that's how I got into punk and pop punk and ska and all that kind of stuff, just by having a friend's band that was doing it. So then I just started going to all those shows and meeting all those bands and just loving that and wanting to be part of the scene. But even at that point, the idea of playing music still wasn't really like on my radar. And I was way more into writing. I went into well, I guess the probably the best way to explain it there was, so when I left Illinois and moved to California, I was still into the independent underground kind of music scenes. And this was kind of pre-internet, So I would want to tell all my friends back home who were all the cool bands in Southern California that they would have no idea who they could possibly be because they don't tour and you wouldn't have seen them. So I would start writing up kind of reviews and made my own kind of makeshift zine that I would send to my friends just to explain to them the kind of bands they should be checking out.
So I'm sorry, so sorry. So while you were in California, like when you went to San Diego, you were writing about like the San Diego stuff going on at the time, which I'm assuming was like gravity and like things of that nature. And then you would like send that zine to your Illinois people. Okay.
And then that I can't ever do anything simply. So the zine turned into, I think we were printing 15,000 copies on newsprint and paying for it with advertisers. And eventually it grew to a staff of maybe 15 people or something like that.
Wow.
And we'd give them out at, the Warped Tour or record stores or whatever. So that's sort of where I was getting more and more into the music world. And as a part of that, I had to learn design because it was a physical magazine and I had to lay it out to send it to the printer. So I had to teach myself layout and composition and typography and all of those things, really just as a means to an end. But I wasn't really thinking about it in terms of design. It was just I need to make a magazine. That sort of then turned into, record labels would say, "Hey, we want to get an ad, but we don't have any artwork." And I'd say, "No, I really need your $60. I'll make you an ad." And then they would come back later and say, "Hey, can you make the ad in this other size?" And I was like, "Well, that's not the size of our magazine." And they're like, "Oh, we're going to use it for these other magazines." And then that sort of turned into more and more design work without really ever having intended to do design work. So as I was doing that, I was still interested in writing. I still thought that was kind of what I was doing or what the goal was. And I was studying English in college, thinking I was going to be a writer, a English professor or something. And about that time in the mid late 90s, I came across some text-to-speech software where you would type words out phonetically and then a robot voice would try to say them. So I thought that was fun and interesting and charming. And I started pairing that with like instrumental MIDI stuff, just as kind of like a fun, goofy joke thing. And I still wasn't really seeing it as a band or as a music outlet. It was more of a, all the songs were very narrative. So it was just a way to like tell short stories over music using this weird robot voice. So that's kind of, in the mid 90s, that's when Satanic Puppeteer Orchestra started as sort of an artifact of discovering text-to-speech software and wanting an outlet to tell these goofy, weird little stories.
Let me go back a little bit to just get everything straight. I apologize if you already said the name, but what was the name of the zine you were making?
It's called Hand Carved Magazine.
Oh, okay, hand carved graphics
Graphics ended up
magazine.
just
Got it.
being the same thing. And because people already knew me as that, so I just stuck with the same thing.
Sure. So did you play in bands like during the Satanic Puppeteer run, have you also played in other bands, or has that been your main project?
Pretty much the only band I have ever been in. I have guested on friends' bands, very briefly or like on a song here or there, but I've never like played in another band legit.
For a particular reason, like, is it creatively not as satisfying as just being your own, like, have
Probably.
yeah.
I mean, I'm probably hard to work with. I think there's a reason I'm in a band with a robot. Like it's sort of, there's no one to push back on my crazy ideas, so I can just go all in and do whatever I want with no checks and balances. I mean, like it's not to say that I wouldn't ever consider it, but I mean, I'm happy just doing this project at this point.
Yeah, no, I've played in some bands in my time, and now that seems like really grueling, the idea of like ever getting back into that. Just the idea of like, all right, I gotta meet at this place this day and this day a week, and then go through like these songs and then go through them again and whatnot. And then you also have to like kind of maintain some relationship of sorts with said people. Otherwise, it's just like awkward if they're your coworkers. So, and then also in the case of like what you do, like I would imagine that there would be a lot of people that maybe wouldn't understand the robot vision.
That's fair. Yeah, the thing I love about it is that in my eyes, it's the Satanic Puppeteer Orchestra is just this giant umbrella. Like if I were to write a novel, I get to the end of writing a novel and now the novel is written and I'm done and that project is complete and now you got to move on to something else. But with this band, like there is no end. It just can go on forever and there's no medium that it's necessarily tied to. Like I can write songs until I get tired of writing songs, and then I can go learn to make music videos until I get tired of making music videos. I just made a video game and it's still part of this same umbrella. So every creative project and instinct that I feel like following, I can kind of loosely tie together as another thing that this band is doing or releasing, and it's all kind of working towards the same end goal, you know? So I really love that about it.
Why did you start calling yourself the Satanic Puppeteer? I think that was like a thing that, especially in today's day and age, that kind of highlighted your project for me, like on the internet. Like I couldn't imagine how difficult it would be for a band to be called like The Who. Or Big Star or something like that in today's day and age when it's like there's just so much information, but then you see Satanic Puppeteer and then you notice it no matter what. But how did you come across that moniker?
So when I first started doing all the band stuff, the m my probably preferred medium is satire in some way or another. So, because I was doing the music magazine and I worked at a bunch of radio stations and I was dealing with the music industry, I would just see all these ridiculous things that were part of the music industry that I felt took itself very seriously and needed to be poked fun at. So, I mean, it's probably been going on for a lot longer, but I felt very present in the mid-90s where a band would choose three mismatched words and put them together, and that would be their band name. You know, you've got Stone Temple Pilots or Jimmy Eat World or, you know, Strawberry Alarm Clock or, you know, I mean, it just goes on forever. So I knew I wanted to do that, but I wanted to pick the most absurd three words that I could pick to sort of highlight how bizarre and ridiculous it all is. So I picked Satanic because I liked it's almost kind of confrontational. It's got this like forbidden kind of quality to it. Like, you know, I was always drawn into all the like scary kind of heavy metal imagery and mythology as a kid. All the stuff that your parents didn't want you to listen to seemed really exciting. So I wanted something that kind of evoked that. And then I liked orchestra because of the irony of it being me and a robot, and you would think of, you know, and it's very lo-fi, maybe less so in recent years, but it started very lo-fi. And you know, orchestra is sort of the, you know, takes itself very seriously and has, you know, tons of top musicians as a part of it. So that was sort of why I picked orchestra. And then puppeteer sort of like speaks to, I don't know, the dynamic potentially between either the robot and I, or the audience and I, or somewhere in there. As an English major, I always want stuff to mean something and to have layers of symbolism going. So that was sort of what I was drawn to with the puppeteer.
As a fellow English major, I understand. So yeah, I was under the impression I initially that the Satanic Puppeteer was like your moniker, and then realized that you're also professor or not Satanic Puppeteer. So that's a whole separate thing, but you're Professor B. Miller, and then yes, okay.
Yeah, I wanted my mad scientist character to have some kind of, title of some with some sort of, authority behind it. But I also liked the ridiculousness that like it's a made up title and I could call myself anything and you don't go for doctor or something, you go for professor, I thought that was kind of fun. And I also like that it's more about teaching or something like that. Like I'm trying to, communicate lessons here.
No, that totally makes sense.
Yeah.
Did you build the SBO 20 yourself?
So the physical robot I had sketched up, and my father-in-law is a car guy, so he was adept at all of the welding and sheet metal work and stuff. So he's the one that actually built the physical robot.
Wow. Okay. How heavy is that? How hard is that to take from like place to place?
It is the reason I only play probably two or three shows a year. It is, among other reasons, but it comes apart, so it's manageable. But it's got like a steel internal skeleton, and it weighs a lot. It's, hundreds of pounds probably when you fully assemble it. But the feet come off, and then it comes apart at the hips, and then the head comes off, so you can kind of break it down. But when you're playing, especially if it's like a three-band bill and I'm in the middle and I've got to like build the robot in between sets and then tear them down after I play, it's not ideal. So
And
yeah.
you sync him up with the music, right? Like he's like,
Yeah.
yeah.
So I like as a one and or two person band, depending on how you count, when we're on stage, I'm very, I don't know if self-conscious is quite the right word, but cognizant of the fact that there aren't a lot of pieces on stage, so I'm trying to make it as interesting as possible. So we have an entire set of videos that are projected on a screen behind us as we play that are synced with every song. So they're usually repurposed ephemeral films from like the 1950s and 60s that are edited to match whatever the content of the song is. And then you've got the like a closed captioning kind of subtitles for the robot so you can understand exactly what he's saying, because I don't want people to miss. He can be kind of hard to understand. I mean, maybe no worse than a human singer, maybe even easier to understand than a lot of human singers, but the words are very important to what we're doing, so they're all on the screen as well. So anytime we play a show, it's like, and I don't like doing the same thing twice because it's just not interesting or fun for me. So every show we play is pretty different. So it's like developing a half hour TV show on top of having to build and unbuild and rebuild a robot on stage and bring our own light show and all this other stuff. So it's quite a project.
So the video is like both, where it's like the repurposed 50s footage, and then there's words like in that same screen.
Yeah, it's designed to look like a maybe a 1980s computer interface where you've got a column that's got a bunch of gauges and there's like a Pong emulation happening and some like a crowdometer, and then there's a top row that's got the lyrics, and then maybe 3/4 of the screen is filled up with those ephemeral videos, and that
Okay.
interface is kind of the same throughout the set, just the content on it changes.
Where did you come across the footage?
A lot of it comes from archive.org,
Okay.
or wherever I can find it from. Sometimes I'll make stuff, but usually I try to repurpose vintage stuff because I like the aesthetic of that better.
Sure. Do you play on Satanic Puppeteer albums, do you play all of the, like, as opposed to it being like MIDI or samples or whatnot, or a lot of it you playing the instruments?
It is a mix of all of those things. So, especially as we've gotten into our 20 themed album series, it's kind of whatever that genre that we're playing for that album requires is what we'll do. So, we did like a metal album. So, there's like some MIDI drum programming we did, but all the guitars are real guitars, you know.
That you play?
No, I suck at
Okay.
guitar. So on that album, we had done an, I say we, and usually I'm talking about the robot and I as we, but my brother, who's actually a really good musician, he recorded on the majority of our themed albums up until recently. And he was in a band called Beta Factor that was like if Iron Maiden and Kraftwerk were a thing.
Damn.
They were pretty fun. And he toured with, there was a band called Finch that was pretty big a while ago, and he played keyboards on their album. And so as I was recording with my brother, we did a Nautical album, and I was like, man, this song could use some mandolin. That would be great. And he's like, oh, my old guitar player from Beta Factor, he plays mandolin. So we had him come in to record mandolin, and before he was recording that part, he started doing these warm-up heavy metal licks just to get in the spirit for this thing. And as he was doing that, I was like, man, I would love to do a heavy metal album with that kind of guitar. Like, you're just ripping this thing. And he was like, okay, let's do it. So after we did the Nautical one, my brother and I recorded the drums and bass and lyrics for the entire album. And then we had our friend Matt, who did guitar, come in and do one of the songs. And after the one song, it was clear he wasn't going to do any of the other songs. So we had a metal album with one song worth of guitar, and that's not something I can fake my way through. So that just sat for maybe a year or so. And then on Instagram, there was a guy that was doing Rocktober, and he was just putting videos of himself playing a different cover song every day. And one of them happened to be one of our songs that never had guitar, and he wrote a guitar part for our song and put it a video of him playing it. It was amazing. So I reached out to him and said, hey, do you want to play on one of our new songs? We've got a whole metal album. And he came and did one of our songs and crushed it. And I was like, hey, do you want to do another song and another song and another song? So I ended up getting him, Scott, to finish that whole metal album. And then when we were done with that album, he was like, well, I guess this is it. We're done with this metal album. And I was like, well, you're a really good guitar player and you're fun to work with. So, what other genres are you interested in? So since then, he's been on pretty much all of our records. So
Yeah, I was impressed. Sorry, go ahead. What were you saying?
we taught him surf guitar. He never played surf guitar, but I was like, it's just metal, but without all the distortion and all the pedals, like different pedals. So he learned surf guitar for that album, and has been on all, like, we just put out an industrial one that's got a ton of his guitar on it. But yeah, so if there's ever guitar, it's usually Scott is the one playing it.
Yeah, I was impressed that like the Face Your Fears album, like the medley one, how like when you get to that point, the guitar is like, okay, this isn't just like somebody trying to play metal all of a sudden for like a goof. And
No, yeah.
similarly to like the Surf the Web album, how it's like, seems legit. Or the Get Down to Business album, the industrial one. I was enjoying the samples in it. I don't know if that was like a purposeful nod to Ministry,
Oh, absolutely.
but I appreciated that like every album that I've heard that's like going for a specific genre, like it seems like there's actual like homework and appreciation that goes into that thing, as opposed to just like, oh, I'm just gonna make this just for the heck of it. And I also like that, like with that concept of it being, like a robot singing it, that you could lyrically and musically just like go anywhere, and that it all kind of like points back to this thing being cohesive because robot singing all of it.
You nailed it. Yep. I when I was doing the music magazine, I also was music director at the college radio station at San Diego State. So that's when I was listening to, 300 CDs that would get submitted a week to try to determine what gets added to the library. And after a while, if it's got a couple guitars, bass, and drums, you've heard it before. Like you've heard all these before. So I was drawn to all the different genres that we would get in, like the weirder, the better. So, that my taste got super warped at that point. But if there was something interesting that was going on in a genre, I would find it eventually, and I loved it. So there's pretty much nothing off limits. Like I love music, and I love all kinds of music, which is one of the reasons we're doing this 20 themed albums, is because like I have a legitimate love and appreciation for all these genres that we're doing. They're not just like a goof at all, as you could tell. Like so, as we're approaching any one of these genres, I'll definitely spend a bunch of time going back through all my favorite stuff and then trying to find new stuff and trying to identify patterns or tendencies or, the things that I like best about what make that genre unique. And spend a lot of time researching it, but yeah, that's so that you definitely caught on. I mean, that's what we're going for, is to try to go on a tour of all of our favorite types of music. And like on that metal record, even within that metal genre, each song on that album, we tried to kind of pay homage to a different subgenre of metal. So we've got like our 70s British metal song, and we've got our like sludgy 90s Melvins kind of song, and then we've got our like desert metal, like Queens of the Stone Age or Caius or whatever kind of song, and then we've got the like more technical, newer metal kind of songs on there. Like we try to cover all. It's like I don't know if I'm ever going to do another metal album, so I'm just going to do all the versions of it that I can while I can.
So, do you play like backing tracks when you're doing these live?
Yeah, I can't do all of it by myself for sure.
But you're playing like keyboard, it looks like you're playing.
It does look like that, yes.
So so are you acting more as like a dancer, like a stage prop then?
Yeah, I would say it's a lot of performance art.
Was there anyone in particular that influenced that for you that you saw live?
Probably not. I think I just have sort of m made it up as I went along, and necessity is the mother of invention, and you just have to like, here's the thing I'm trying to achieve. What do I know how to do that could achieve that, and then piece it together. I don't think I've seen, I mean, my band is already so weird. It's not like I can even explain my band by saying like, oh, it just sounds like these other bands. Like I wouldn't even know where to start. And I think the live show is more of that. And the live show is way about experiences too. We have an album that's called Have an Existential Crisis. And I figured if one thing about our band, it's that we have a robot singer, because we change genres every album. It's hard to pin us down, but we always have a robot singer. So for that Existential Crisis album, in addition to having the words on the songs be about alternate realities and the meaning of life and these sorts of things I'm struggling with, the vinyl is pressed with parallel grooves. So when you drop the needle, you either get the robot singing or you get a human guest singer and no robot at all. And you can't control which of those versions you're going to get when you drop the needle. So that's the album, and that's the experience of the album. And then it also comes with decoder glasses, that there's a two-sided puzzle, there's like a QR code in the liner notes that doesn't work unless you shoot it through the decoder glasses, and then you get a dub version of the album. Like it's a very interactive kind of thing. So when we were playing that live, I wanted to figure out how to bring some of that into that show. So I developed this technique. I don't know that I've ever seen it before, where I have a set of red and white videos and a set of blue and white videos that I layer on top of each other. And I give the audience either red decoder glasses or blue decoder glasses. And whichever color decoder glasses you're wearing for those songs determines which of the two versions of the videos you see. So mm-hmm. we have a song called like Reboot the Simulation. So half the audience sees these 1960s scientists in lab coats and shirts and ties that are experimenting with the first ever graphic user interface using these light pens in their like lab. Or if you're wearing the other glasses, you see a woman who is on acid and trapped in a mannequin factory just freaking out. So you're standing right next to someone and you're watching objectively the same thing, but you leave with completely different impressions and experiences, depending on the color glasses that you happen to be wearing.
So basically, just so I understand this correctly, so basically there's two videos that are on top of each other, mm-hmm. and one is two colors and one is two other colors, and then the 3D glasses, like, I've never tried to make a 3D anything, but basically it's like the way that the 3D glasses works is like the color of the glasses like correlates with the color scheme of the video.
Yeah, so and usually you think of 3D glasses as one red lens and one blue lens, but these, they're both red lenses or they're both blue lenses. So if you've got both red lenses and the video is red and blue, essentially, the red kind of disappears if you're wearing red glasses, and the blue mixes with the red of your lenses and becomes like a black or a dark purple. So it becomes really prominent and the red just kind of vanishes. And the opposite happens if you're wearing the blue glasses. The blue video kind of disappears. The red gets multiplied by the blue and becomes this dark purpley kind of color. So you can only make out one or the other. It's pretty, like, I the see. Decoder glasses isn't a new thing. Like, that's been around since I was a kid, but I've never seen
right.
video done with decoder glasses before.
Yeah, yeah.
So those are the kinds of things we like to do live, is like part of a way to make it an experience rather than just, you know, listen to our songs and politely clap at the end.
Right. I mean, I have so little interest at this point in my life in seeing people in street clothes just recreating the music that they recorded.
Right. I could just listen to that at home, you know.
Right. One thing that I was thinking about when I was going through the merchandise, and this includes like the 3D glasses, or I was flipping through the High Score magazine
yeah.
that you've made for the Phantom Quest video game, and I read a lot of like early 90s like GamePro magazine, and I'm going to guess that you did too.
You're correct, yes.
I read over the summer, I read the book Stupid TV Be More Funny that came out in the last like year or two, and basically it was about 90s Simpsons. Like, it was the, you know, just the behind the scenes of how those episodes were written. But one thing that they talked about regularly is like, the people in that writer's room were all raised on TV and pop culture, and how that's like basically like the show and all of the layers of jokes and whatnot, how those are just layers upon layers of like people just like watching hours and hours of television and then picking up on this pop culture reference or that or like whatnot. And I kind of picked up on that with your media as well, be it like the 3D glasses route, like, you know, something that you would read and, you know, at the in the back of like a 90s comic book or something.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Was there, I used to ask people for a few episodes. I did this regularly where I would like ask people what their like for like an particularly like influential album and or movie and or book. And then I kind of dropped that after a while because I think that that's interesting to me, but I didn't know if that was like a very interesting question to put out into the universe. But I'm just gonna like throw that out there for you if there was like any of those things or any other thing that's like was particularly influential to your art, be it the Satanic Puppeteer Orchestra or your visual art or whatever.
Sure. I mean, I would imagine I would imagine most creative people, all books and movies and music are so important that the idea of trying to narrow it down is unthinkable. But for the purposes of our discussion, if we're going to talk about books, the ones that come to mind that sort of would tell s interesting stories potentially, one is I don't know how many people have heard of him, but the author is Raymond Fetterman. He was like this postmodern kind of surrealist, and he wrote a book called Double or Nothing. And now the reason why it's important to me is because when I was at San Diego State, I was taking an English class as an English major, and the instructor that was supposed to teach the class had some health emergency and was unable to teach the class. And this author, this French author, Raymond Fetterman, had just retired and moved to San Diego, and they reached out to him to ask if he would like guest teach this class just because the semester was about to start and they needed someone to teach the class. So I ended up taking a class from Raymond Fetterman, and he had us read maybe one or two novels a week, all just of his favorites that had nothing to do with what the class was supposed to be about. And then we would just show up and talk about the books. And there were no assignments or anything. The one rule in the class was that you can't miss a class. You just have to show up and be a part of it. And if for any reason you ever missed a class, you would have to come with a written excuse and you would present it to him. And it had to be an excuse that no one had ever heard before in their life. And he just relished in the opportunity to hear these excuses. So as soon as someone would miss a class, he was waiting for that next week for that person to show up so he could read whatever the crazy excuse was. And he'd immediately just snatch it out of their hands and start reading it aloud to the class in his thick French accent. And of course, by the end of the semester, there was a trip or something that I was on, and I ended up missing the class. So I had to come up with an excuse that no one had ever heard before. And having heard a bunch of the other excuses, they're all very like standard fare. They just tried to get weirder with it. So I did the kind of, weird excuse that everyone else was doing, where you just make up a new combination of things that people might not have heard. Mine was that, these real estate agents really wanted to sell my house, and they just kept pestering me about it and pestering me about it to the point where they ended up kidnapping me and sticking me in their RE/MAX hot air balloon. And I was stranded in this hot air balloon and I couldn't make it to class. But I knew that he was going to read it in front of the whole class. So as I'm writing this description of what had happened to me, I put in these interjections of him as the speaker because I know he's reading it with all these, ridiculous things that he's saying and this running commentary about how amazing of an excuse this is as it's going, and then talking about all of his favorite French things and going off on weird tangents where I just have him rambling for no reason for like a page or two. And the class had no idea what was happening because it sounds exactly like something he would do. And, so after that excuse, we were just the best of friends. And and Double or Nothing is probably my favorite book of his, where it's sort of this story of, him wanting to go to, I don't know, Las Vegas and just, post up in a hotel for a year while he writes a book. But the book is about him trying to figure out how he would even go about doing that and trying to figure out, like, if I never leave my hotel, how much toothpaste would I need and how many squeezes of toothpaste per day would I use and how many are in a tube? And he just goes down these crazy rabbit holes. And it's a very weird book, but it just reminds me of him and my time with him. And that's why I love that book. Another kind of weird book suggestion would be a more modern one. I read books with my daughter all the time, and I've come across one called My Pet Feet by Josh Funk. And it's just such a clever premise where the letter R gets stolen or is missing. So everything in this little girl's world is now missing the letter R. So she has a ferret that's her pet, but the R is missing. So now it's feet, not ferret. So as she looks through the town to try to find him, everything in the town is now missing the letter R. So it's a really imaginative and interesting story, and the visuals are wonderful, but it's just such a clever conceit, and the way they play with language throughout the entire thing is really fun to see them avoid the letter R as they're writing this entire story.
Yeah, that reminds me of, have you heard of the book, A Void by Jorge Perec? I don't know if that's how you pronounce his like French name, but it was like a book that came out of the mid-century time, and it was like during this period where like French writers were trying to be particularly like abstract and like make new rules to write books into. But anyway, this book is completely missing the letter E. And not only that, but then it was like originally in French, so then you like read it in English and it's just like fat shit. I don't even know how that would like work to translate that, but yeah, that,
nice. Yeah, there's another one similar called Alphabetical Africa, where the first chapter only has words that start with the letter A. And the second chapter has words that start with A or B, and it goes on and on and on, and then it stops, and then it goes backwards until the last chapter is just A's again.
Holy shit.
That was one that Ray Fetterman taught in that class. That's how I found out about that one. But it makes almost no sense, but it's a fun exercise anyway.
What about like any other artists or albums or movies or anything?
Yeah, so for movies, I love like the classic highbrow kind of stuff, but I also really am drawn to like the crazy B movie outsider art where like they clearly didn't have a lot of budget, but they had a lot of imagination and ingenuity. And those ones are always a ton of fun. I love all that kind of stuff. I'd be hard pressed to pick one of those crazy B movies. As far as stuff that's influenced my band, probably more like, you know, the 50s sci-fi stuff like Forbidden Planet or The Day the Earth Stood Still, or, you know, stuff like that is definitely influenced like visually what we're going for. I love the movie True Stories by David Byrne. That one's a ton of fun, where he had been collecting all these articles while touring of all these weird things that had happened, and then he strung them all together into a single narrative for the movie. That's a great one. I find all that kind of stuff really inspiring. Is this for a song? I wouldn't even know where to start. I can't even pick favorite albums by the bands that I love. You know, in San Diego, we've got John Reese. I love anything John Reese has ever done. Rock from the Crypt and Hot Snakes and Drive Like Jehu and all of his new solo stuff. I love all that stuff. That's probably my favorite stuff.
Drive Like Jehu is a band that I just got into like the last like year or so. I liked Hot Snakes like a long time ago, but I since I'm blanking out on the person who passed away recently.
Rick Froberg.
Yes, Rick Froberg. Yeah, so it wasn't until he passed away that I started seeing people who in bands that I like and whatnot posting about how influential this band was, and then I actually listened to those like first couple albums after years and years of hearing that name.
Yeah, I love that stuff. That one, so I already knew Rocket from the Crypt, and I got into them in probably the early 90s, and I knew that John Reese was also in Drive Like Jehu, so I just bought it not knowing anything about it, assuming it was going to sound like Rocket from the Crypt, and it doesn't sound anything like Rocket from the Crypt. But this was in a time where I might have only owned 20 or 30 albums at the time. So like I spent a lot of money on this thing, so I'm going to keep listening to it, and I just kept listening to it over and over, and eventually I just grew to love it. As wildly different as it is from anything else I'd ever heard at the time. When they got back together and played the show in Balboa Park at the Oregon Pavilion, that was one of my favorite shows I ever went to. That was insane.
Yeah, I'm curious, like, what it is about San Diego that, because a lot of the music of the 90s and early 2000s that came out of that was really influential to me personally in the way that it was like abrasive, but also like effeminate and weird. Something that I could like relate to personally a lot more than something that's just like, straight up
Aggro,
testosterone
yeah.
driven. Yeah, aggro. But then San Diego seems like such a nice place. Like when I visited, like the temperature and whatnot, like I and the beach, like it's it always kind of baffled me how music that weird and angry came out of there. I don't know if that sounds
No, I
weird
think
coming from an
that might
outsider.
be the reason that music comes out of here. It's sort of like our rebellion against the beach and that culture. 'Cause like I almost never go to the beach, and I feel like a tourist if I'm at the beach. Like I feel completely out of place. Like those aren't my people. But I love San Diego, but I almost don't even associate it with that culture.
I like the seals.
Yeah, the seals and children's beaches, it's great. But yeah, but just hanging out in the sand, it's not for me at all. But yeah, San Diego music is super incredible. I love all of it. It's we've got, Mrs. Magician is working on a new record. I don't know if you're familiar with them. I would highly recommend them. My friend Jacob is their singer, and they started out kind of like if the Beach Boys were in a garage rock band, I guess. John Reese put it out on his record label. They're one of my favorites. Schizophonics puts on one of the craziest live shows I've ever seen. I get tired just watching them play. They just go nuts. All the Paul Jenkins stuff, like 3 Mile Pilot and Blackheart Procession and Mr. Toop and the Flying Objects, all his stuff is amazing.
I saw Blackheart Procession open for Fugazi
Oh, nice.
in early 2001, and I hadn't heard of them by that point, and was just kind of, baffled a little bit. Like, I really liked it, but just
That's a jarring combination of bands.
that's a jarring combination of bands. Yeah,
Yeah.
so I really appreciated that that was like the opener for,
Yeah.
like, almost the way that, like, Fugazi famously discouraged, like, that really aggressive, like, moshing and whatnot. Like, having that band open for them is also almost like an additional fuck you to, like, that kind of person.
Sure.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the video game Phantom Quest that you made, and I have very limited knowledge of how these things work. I know it's more accessible to make video games than like it ever has been, but I can't make sense of it. So as far as like me having like a discourse with you about like how you did A or B or C, like I feel like I would just make an ass of myself, but I am curious like how long it took for you to learn how to make a video game to begin with, and how you taught yourself.
So, going into the like, we wanted to make a video game themed album because, like, growing up in the 80s and 90s, those 8-bit, Nintendo soundtracks are just sort of ingrained in my brain, like Castlevania and Mega Man, like they've got some incredible music. So I've always wanted to do an album of that. So we did an album of that, and I'm trying to figure out always how do you make a bigger thing of this theme and how do you package the release in a more, all-encompassing way. So it was like, well, obviously I got to figure out how to make a video game. So I started just trying to figure out how to do like a quick mobile phone, like match these shapes kind of game. And it just felt, inauthentic and uninspired, So then I was like, well, if I'm going to make a game for real, what I would want is like a 1990s Nintendo game, like Zelda or something like that, but you play as our band. So there's this sort of thing as like a creative person, at least for me, where I call it like the curse of the idea. So once I get this idea in my head, I can't move on until it exists. And then once it exists, I can get it out of my head. But I knew if I didn't try to make it, it would just haunt me forever. So once I had the idea, I knew I had to try to figure out a way to do it. So having never made a video game before, I spent some time researching how do you even make a video game? And I came across this software called RPG Maker. And it came out in the mid-90s and still used today. And it's really geared towards mostly like Japanese role-playing games where you have like a character that goes and battles and on battles, and once you defeat the enemy, you get experience points, and the more experience points you can trade, you can level up and become more powerful, so you can beat bigger enemies, and then you can earn more gold or whatever, and you can buy better weapons. So that's what the software is geared towards. And I didn't want it to do any of that stuff because that all sounds boring and lame and not interesting to me at all. I wanted a format that lets me tell my stories and has some, ability to make the characters move around and have sound effects and stuff like that. So I used that software and I pretty much gutted all of the stuff that it's built to do. And then I left all the stuff where, you can assign character sprites, which is like a exploded view of your character where you've got them facing every direction on one sort of image. And then as the game is using it, when you're moving your character around, it knows which of those directions to show, so it looks like the character is moving the right direction. So it already had all that kind of stuff built into it. It has, so it had the dialogue things that were built into it, all the software to handle that kind of stuff. It had all the map making stuff in it. So what I had to do is figure out, well, first, what story am I trying to tell? So I spent months and maybe a couple hundred pages writing out what the story of the game would be. So ours is, because we're doing 20 themed albums, I thought it'd be fun to do a tw 20 quests, and each quest is based on one of our songs. So it's this wide open world where you wander around and talk to people like you would have in Dragon Warrior or Zelda or whatever. And some of those people will send you on quests. And then once you complete the quest, you get some item and then you move on and try to find another quest. So I wrote out, a script to figure out what are these 20 quests. And then who are the characters you're interacting with? What are the environments you're going to interact with them in? So once I had my script, I kind of could see, okay, I'm going to need a laundromat, a movie theater, an ice cream parlor, all the things that I'd sort of written into my script. So then I started making maps based on my script to kind of encapsulate all of the world that I needed. And then I started inhabiting that world with all the characters, and then putting all the dialogue in, and slowly kind of built up to having a playable game. I made some prototypes at the very beginning just to kind of see what the boundaries were, what was possible, that I could do, achieve what I was trying to. And once I could kind of confirm, yeah, this approach is going to work, then I just kind of went all in to try to figure out all those pieces kind of one at a time and build through all of that. From beginning to end, it was probably a 2-year process. When I started, I had no idea it was going to take me that long. I would have guessed 3 to 6 months. but it's just so much more stuff to do than I had given it credit for. And part of it's on me because I made it more complicated because I make everything more complicated. But like if you talk to a character and he sends you on a quest and you go talk to that character again, I didn't want him to just give you the same dialogue again. I want him to say like, "Hey, how's that quest going?" And then once you finish the quest, he goes, "Oh, thanks for doing that quest," or whatever. So it has some context for what's actually happening. And that's totally possible, but the way you do it in the game is through this like conditional logic where it's just a series of if else. So if this thing has happened, then do this, else do this other thing. So throughout the game, I'm constantly setting switches or variables and keeping track of stuff so that my non-playable characters know what's going on and can react appropriately as the game is progressing.
I admire that level of patience. A lot of what I choose to do creatively, on to be perfectly honest, has a lot to do with my lack of willingness to do very much. So, like, there was a period a few years ago where I was trying to do like more poetry and whatnot, and the thing that was like so appealing to me about that was that I could write this thing and then I'm done, and then write this other thing and then I'm done, as opposed to trying to do something that's, because my ADHD is just like fucking off the rails, and so I lose interest in you ever see the movie Adaptation? You know how in the middle of it or so, Chris Cooper's character is talking about how, I studied blank fish and blank fish and blank fish. Then one day I just decided, fuck fish. Like, I'm done with, like, that's basically how I am with things. Whereas, like, just like going back to like the video game magazine even, and how there was like the that card that was like in the middle of it for like the download code, where I was just like admiring, like, wow, he actually had to like go get these printed. And then the robot, you got to carry the robot around. I don't know.
I totally appreciate your desire for projects that you can complete. And doing design work, my favorite thing to do is probably concert posters because I can knock them out in a couple hours and be done and move on with my life. And there's something very rewarding about having something to show for your time at the end of the day that's complete. The only way I can do something like this video game thing is to try to break it down into much smaller components. So if you approach it thinking I'm going to make this massive video game that's going to take 9 hours, that's just too overwhelming. So I would look at it as like I just need to write the dialogue for this one interaction, and then as soon as I'm done with that, cool, now I'll move on to this next puzzle piece, And there were definitely times where I had to put it aside and work on other stuff for a while before I was ready to come back to it. But I knew I needed to finish it, so it was kind of this nagging thing. But yeah, without breaking it into smaller projects, I don't think I would have ever gotten it done.
Going just with the variety of things that you do, like, is there a way that you keep various tasks like in order as far, like, at least as far as your own things are concerned? Not necessarily something you're hired to do, but like, is there a way you prioritize, like, I'm going to do this versus this and put it in a way where it's like actually leading to like an end result? Or how do you even figure out like what you feel like working on at said time with like balancing those various ideas?
So, the band stuff usually is kind of scheduled where once a week, usually Monday nights, I'm meeting with guitar player Scott, and that's usually when most of the band stuff happens. So, I do that for a few reasons. One, having like something on the calendar every week kind of makes me feel accountable. Like I can't let Scott down. I gotta show up and be prepared and have something for us to work on. And then even if it's only 3 or 4 hours a week, I'm always making progress towards whatever that larger goal is. And usually it, like, because of the way the band is structured, we've never had a band practice in 20 years. Like, we don't spend time doing that.
Right.
So any band time is usually spent creating, be it preparing for a show or something, or writing music for an album. So, you know, in a 3-hour meeting on a Monday night, we can usually maybe not finish a complete song, but get most of the way there. So maybe, you know, depending on the genre too, like metal songs were a lot harder to write. So they might've taken, you know, 5 or 6 sessions before we'd get one down. But a lot of the like synth rock stuff we can do in, you know, a week and a half of meetings, we'll have it all done. So usually what happens, you know, we'll get 3/4 of the way through a song. And then over the course of that next week, whenever I'm in my car, I'm listening to the rough mix and thinking of what's bugging me about it, or thinking of, you know, the lyrics, or whatever, so that by the time the next Monday rolls around, I'm prepared and have, you know, a direction for us to go. And usually the way that it works is, it's, I mean, in 20 years of any way you can write a song, I've probably written a song, but the way it usually works now, like I really enjoy restrictions as a creative person. And the more restrictions I have, the easier it is to be creative. So, so I already know I'm doing 20 themed albums. So once I start a theme, I know what the theme is. I usually know what the genre is. And I try to fit everything on one side of a vinyl so I can do like an etched B side or something. So I've got 21 minutes of a specific theme and genre to fill up. So now I kind of know what my goal is. And I try to start writing song titles that speak to that theme and amuse me on some level. And I'll have, you know, maybe 10 or 15 song titles. And I don't usually have anything more developed than a song title. So then when we meet, I'll pick one of the song titles and go, this is the song we're going to try to write. And usually the name alone gives you some, you know, hint at the tempo or the feel or the mood of the song. And sometimes I'll have actual, maybe not finished lyrics, but an idea of the lyrics, or a bunch of random verses that I'll kind of pair up with the music as we go. And then it's kind of a weaving back and forth. Once you've get some of the music, then I write more of the words. And then once you layer the words in, now I can do more of the music. And then they kind of happen back and forth until the thing finishes. So that's usually how that works. So I'm usually chipping away at it throughout the week whenever I've got time or an idea. But the bulk of the work happens in that one small window once a week. For other creative projects, you know, it's usually, for someone else. Like I'm doing album artwork for a band that I'm friends with or something like that. And then it just gets stuck on the list. And I try to just go through the list based on when things are due or when they need them by, you know, and just try to get through it all. And if I've got too much on the list, I just start telling people no until the list gets shorter.
Is it mainly just like doing some art for musicians and whatnot?
Usually, yeah. I mean, in the past I've done freelance for, you know, everyone from NBA and Adidas to La Quinta Inns and Suites. And I've done stuff for like Chuck E. Cheese. I don't do a lot of corporate stuff right now. I've done more, I enjoy the band stuff more. So I try to find projects that are more fun for me to work on. But if the right project comes along and it sounds interesting, I'm certainly open to it.
And that's all under the, hand-carved graphics. The hand-carved umbrella.
Yeah.
Okay. So basically with, the Satanic Puppeteer Orchestra, it's like Monday nights that you get like the bulk of it worked on that you're going to work on for the week. And then the rest of the time throughout the week, you're kind of just like maybe just revisiting it when you can and just like thinking about it.
Yeah.
So like, there isn't really, because for me, I've been trying to get out of like the mindset of trying to be like productive or whatever. Like that was when I think started this podcast, I was like trying to kind of figure out ways to make like my system better so I could like make more stuff. And I think that there's like still a part of me that's like that, but I'm kind of trying to come to terms with that because I think that there's a lot that you can unpack with that, including just like capitalism and the idea of just like having some sort of self-worth in like quantities of like stuff that you make or whatever. But at the same time, it's like I do like the idea of there being like windows of time where I'm going to like try to work on this thing, and then like if nothing comes of it, then just like whatever. But otherwise, it's like kind of hard for my brain to like oftentimes like I'll be just going about my day, and then I'll just like have an idea for something, and then I'll just kind of like work on that like frantically for like a period of time. So usually the stuff that I do doesn't even like revolve around any sort of time frames, but I do like the idea of that in theory because it kind of helps me structure my brain just like a little bit. But for you, do you kind of have that with professional or otherwise projects where it's just like, all right, I'm going to work on this at like 10 or whatever?
Yeah, I get what you're saying. Momentum is definitely a thing. And like when you're excited about an idea, it's a lot more fun to work on it. And that's kind of when you try to capture that when you can. My approach was kind of maybe warped or defined when I was in college. I took this illustrating class, and I'm passable at it, but I'm not a very good illustrator. I'm a very confident designer, but not an illustrator. And I was really struggling in this class. And I was talking to the professor about it, and he was like, "Well, your problem is just that you're finishing the drawing in your head, and there's this gap between your tastes and your capabilities." So, I can imagine something and I don't have the ability to achieve that thing. So then, because of this gap between my taste and my abilities, I'm just frustrated and disappointed in it. And he said that, over time, your abilities and capabilities are going to get better and that gap's going to get smaller, but you've got to stop trying to finish an idea in your head. And once you get like the kernel of this idea, stop trying to imagine it and just start trying to make it. And as you're drawing it, you're going to be more open to possibilities, and you'll see stuff on the page that you would have not been open to otherwise because you're imagining what it looks like rather than just being present and seeing what you're creating and being open to whatever is happening. And at the time, that just sounded like a bunch of Zen garbage to me, and I didn't
Sure.
understand him at all. But after years of fighting that, I think it finally sunk in, and that's kind of how I approach a lot of the stuff now, where that's, like I'm writing down the song title and then just setting it aside, and I'm not trying to finish that song yet. I've got an idea for it, but I'm just gonna shelve it until I've got time to work on it. And then when I'm working on it, I'm staying open to it as we're going through it. One of the things I've struggled with and I'm getting better at is like, even when you're writing a part and you're collaborating with someone, you've kind of got an idea of what you want that melody to be for that part of the song or whatever, and they come up with an idea and they're sharing it with you, and your first reaction is, well, that's not what I had in mind. And there's this dissonance between, what your expectation is and what they're presenting you with. And it's not necessarily that it's bad or it's wrong, it's just different. And it takes a while to get past that idea that it's different and then try to objectively evaluate it on its own and determine if it's a good idea or not. So I work really hard at that and trying to just be present and trying to figure out in the moment, is this the right thing that this project calls for, be it a drawing or a poster or a song or whatever. So because of that approach, I think I feel less dependent on time. Like it's because I'm able to, once I have that idea, I'm able to like time capsule that idea and then bring it back when I'm ready. I don't feel like I need to finish it as the idea happens.
Yeah. I liked the book Catching the Big Fish, the David Lynch book. I don't know if you ever read that, but basically it's just like him talking about like his creative process and it all just being like, akin to fishing and just like having the lens be as clear as possible and just kind of having just like a really like open mind. And then when ideas come, the whole thing is just an ad for transcendental meditation, to be honest, because that's
Sure.
like, of course it was,
Of course.
but I did like the idea of it just being like focused on just being open to like whatever happens happening, and just going like with that like as naturally as possible. Because like with me, just like if I've gotten too zeroed in on like a creative form or a creative project, be it like a musical project or like whatever, it's almost like if you as a human being are trying to like mold yourself to this like idea of like who you think you are, and then like that becoming like harder, but you being like really like stern on that versus just like allowing yourself to change or whatever. I don't know if I'm get I might just be I don't even smoke weed, so I don't know if I sound like I'm just high right now, but I
Yeah, me either, but I'm right there with you. I mean,
Right.
you've got it. That's my approach. I don't know that that works for everyone, but that's totally how I approach all these creative projects for sure.
Is there anything else you would like to share with this time? Do you have any questions for me? Anything you any causes you want to speak towards or whatever?
I'd say try to like aim high and swing big, like just go for it. Like it seems kind of audacious that we would publicly announce that we're going to put out 20 albums when most bands probably don't ever put out two albums. But that approach has helped in a lot of ways. One, it shows, that we're confident and that we're planning on doing this for a while. It shows that like creatively it's really helpful because as you're in the prior to this themed album series, we were working on an album for, I don't know, 6 or 7 years, and we ended up with, 12 songs or something at the end of that. And there was just so much scrutiny over every single decision and every single song and trying to figure out how to make every single thing perfect or the best it could be. And once I decided I was going to do 20 albums, that was just gone. And it was very freeing. Like, man, tw 20 albums, 8 songs an album, I got to do 160 of these. Like, I'm not going to agonize over every single one of these. Like, if it's not perfect, it doesn't have to be perfect. It just has to capture that idea to the best of my abilities at that moment in time. And it's a time capsule of that moment in time. And now I'm going to move on and try to do better on the next song. And it is what it is. And that's been a lot more fun and gratifying, and hopefully interesting to people, because I'm more open to ideas than I would have been before. And if you're swinging big on something like that, like what's the worst that can happen? We only put out 15 albums, like that's still a pretty huge accomplishment. Although we're working on number 17 now, so I don't think we'll have a problem getting to 20. I'd also say don't hesitate to ask for help. I mean, what we do is so weird and so n niche and like it's just so out there. And like I have a very clear vision of what I want it to be, and it feels intimidating to try to pull other people into my madness. But I've found more often than not, when you reach out to people, they're very willing to help you. Even people I would have never thought would have given me the time of day. Like I reached out to Dr. Demento and I was like, he should write our liner notes. And he wrote back and was like, immediately, and was like, yes, I would love to write your liner notes. Like we just did this industrial record and I reached out to Martin Atkins, who was in, Nine Inch Nails and Ministry and Public Image Limited and has done TED Talks and written books. Like, and who am I? Like, he's never heard of me before, but he was totally down to help and be a part of it and was excited about it. So like you just never know what's going to happen. Just like reach out to people and Well, you know, the worst that's going to happen is they don't write you back or they say no. Like, just don't be intimidated. Just go for it. And some of the people I'm close friends with now, I only met because I reached out to them for some ridiculous reason and I didn't even know them at the time. And now, you know, we hit it off and now we're buddies. So don't be afraid.
All right, well, thank you for joining me today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.